Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning to listeners on the West Coast and good afternoon to those on the East Coast. My name is Simon Barrett and I will be your host today. This is another in our ongoing series, Surviving the 21st Century, an opportunity to explore the state of health and nutrition in our modern world. As always, I'm joined by my good friends, the writing and research team of Manny Barling and Ashley Brooks. Good morning to both of you.
Oh, good morning, Simon.
Good morning, Simon.
Manny, I have a little story for you, and you'll probably need to take a break just to stop laughing. It shocked me, and I thought my wife, Jan, was going to have heart failure. This week, I broke down and bought an electronic gizmo.
Oh, my God.
Yes, that's an event.
It's not so. I bought myself an e-book reader, and the mail lady delivered it yesterday, and I'm just amazed at how much aggravation can be generated by a device so small. I mean, of course, the manufacturer had opted to get a Mongolian yak herder to translate the manual from Chinese to English, which, you know, which means that, yeah, you got to make a few wild guesses, but I'm pretty certain that computer, they really mean computer.
Is it hard to read on the ebook?
No. Works.
I mean,
great.
Once you get it going, is it hard to read the? So is it like reading a book?
Right. It actually works wonderfully, but.
Simon, you had a little bit of a forewarning about this, that I'm one of the guests today, and he knows that I'm just not going to sit. And I have to tell you, Simon, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, before I retired as a librarian, I read an article about a researcher who had just been studying papyrus texts from Egypt, like 2000 B.C. They were thousands of years old. After he finished that, he tried to do some research on something that had been published in the 1980s electronically, and he wasn't able to do it because the software didn't work. So 500 years from now, that papyrus is still going to be readable. Do you think someone will be able to pick up that e-book and get anything out of it?
Oh,
no,
absolutely.
I don't
agree.
Absolutely
not.
Yeah.
In fact, I was reading the Destructions, and I discovered that I had two choices for downloading books. I could use the simple cable that was included in the box, or the much more esoteric Wi-Fi solution. Well, you know, I'm not a complete Luddite, so, you know, I couldn't resist the challenge. So after 3 hours, much grumping and a whole bunch of aggravation, we're now a two-router household. And you know what? The simple dollar cable works much better. Okay, enough of my Luddite lifestyle. Manny, we do have some special guests this week. Would you like to introduce them?
I certainly would. We've just heard a little bit from Jim Rubis, and Dr. Francis Tickey is going to join us shortly.
He
is with us. Francis, good morning, and welcome to the show. And,
hi, am I coming through?
I don't know, testing 1, 2, 3, are we?
Yes.
Yeah. But, you know, tell the audience a little bit about them. Jim is not an ordinary farmer. He's a farmer in Iowa. He was born on a farm, but he chose to attend college and become a librarian in the small town of Fairfield, Iowa, where he helped people research important issues such as papyrus. And it's amazing because most people who don't know, you know, a librarian don't understand how much they commit to the community and how much effort they give everybody who walk into a library who are inexperienced. Those of us who spend a lot of time in school pretty well know our way around the library, but Jim has helped people with every kind of project from their farms to getting into college to everything that's conceivable within a community.
Francis Tickey's book helped him with the book.
And he helped Francis with his book. But when the time came, he retired back to the farm where he farms 10,000 acres in Iowa. He's a Renaissance man, and people like Jim are the best that America has to offer. His attachment to the roots, his attachment to the intellectual side of our country, gives him a unique view, which you're going to hear during the show, of what Americans face and what I like to call the food revolution. Along with Jim, we have his good friend, Francis Tickey. Francis is a doctor who's been a guest on our show. He's a farmer, scientist, educator, and he's also an advocate and expert on sustainable farming. Francis operates an 80-cow grass-based organic dairy near Fairfield, Iowa, where they produce bottled milk, cheese, and yogurt from their own cows and market them through grocery stores and restaurants in their community, which gives Francis a unique view about every topic we discuss, factory farming, the dairies, the whole number. But he's not an ordinary farmer. His BA is in music and philosophy, also a Renaissance man, with an MS in soil science and a PhD in agronomy with a soil fertility specialty. You know, when I see that, I wonder if they have fertility clinics for soil. But that's another question. After completing his PhD,
unfortunately, industrial agriculture sometimes they provide abortions when you're talking about fertility.
Oh, I'm sure they abort the soil. After completing his PhD, Francis worked in Washington D.C. at the USDA, serving as the national program leader for soil science. He's been appointed by the Iowa governors to the Iowa Environmental Protection Commission, the Iowa Food Policy Council, and the Iowa Organic Standards Boards. He's also served on the USDA State and Technical Committee, the Scientific Congress on Organic Agricultural Research, the Organic Farming Research Foundation Board of Directors, and the Governing Council of the Consortium for Sustainable Agricultural Research. Francis has also testified twice before the U.S. DA committee representing the interests of farmers. Among his many awards are the 2009 Spencer Award for Sustainable Agriculture from the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture, the 2007 Sustainable Agriculture Achievement Award, the Outstanding Pasture Management Award, and the Steward of the Land Award. It'll probably take us another half hour to go through his achievements, and Jim's falling asleep, I'm sure now, but Jim contributed to his book, A New Vision for Iowa Food and Agriculture, which is a wonderful book on sustainable farming. And basically, I consider them, and Ash, you consider them American heroes.
Absolutely.
They fight for the factory farming industry and are living proof that Americans can thrive on the farm, producing quality food for Americans while not damaging the ecology. They believe and practice sustaining the soil in the American tradition.
And protecting people's health.
Yes. And Jim and Francis are the founding fathers of JFAN, the Jefferson County Farmers and Neighbors, Inc., which can be located at jfaniowa.org. And to give you some idea of what they've been doing, on one occasion, JFAN collected 2,000 signatures in just 2 days protesting a new CAFO in their county. You know, CAFOs, which is the primary subject of this show, as well as every aspect of factory and farming, is an acronym for Concentrated Animal Feeding Operations. We just call it factory farming for short. And JFAN publishes interesting newsletters, which are worth reading. You can get online. And the real purpose of our story is to talk about things that are in our book. Some people say, gee, I can't believe that. We get blogs, we publish blogs, we get comments from the industry people who say, gee, you know, you've never been to a CAFO. Come and visit our CAFO. They're wonderful. Well, every time Ash and I offer to hop on an airplane from Los Angeles to Iowa, Nebraska, wherever, to look at a CAFO, of course.
And all their manure lagoons.
Right, of course, they never respond. So we chose Iowa because we find Iowa is a microcosm of America's food revolution. It's America's heartland, the heartland of the food Americans eat every day. Whatever affects growing food in Iowa affects every dinner table across America. To paraphrase an old political expression, as Iowa goes, so goes the health of our nation. Francis, Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Jim, quite an introduction for us.
Well, you know, Francis sent me a money order, so I'm doing the best I can.
Francis, that credit card did work.
Jim, you know, I think you're a good place to start. So tell us about the politics and CAFOs and food issues in Iowa, and tell us more about JFAN, which I'm sure I just scratched the surface of.
Right. Well, first, I want to correct one thing. We talked yesterday about me being a tall tale teller, and I don't want people to think you tell tall tales because I do not farm 10,000 acres.
I wrote it down wrong.
235 acres. The tenant who does some of the cropping on my farm does 10,000 acres, but I'm a small guy, 235 acres. But, you know, you kind of ended up.
Wait a minute, Jim. That's substantial. 235 acres is substantial. So
235. Well, it's, you know, when I was a kid, I grew up on 160 acres, and if somebody had 200 acres, they were the rich farmer.
Same here in Ohio. It's like, oh my gosh, you have how many acres? My mouth dropped. Go ahead, Jim. Sorry.
You kind of summed up or ended talking about politics and also about invitations to visit CAFOs. Well, if you want to visit a CAFO in Iowa and you want to take something back with you other than your memories, you better hurry because the Iowa legislature is looking at a bill and it looks like it has a strong chance of passing where they would prohibit anyone from taking a photograph in any type of farm animal facility. And at this point, technically, you know, if you are uninvited and go into you can be charged with trespassing, so there's already something on the books. But with the new law, even if you had permission to be on the property or you were an employee witnessing something, if you took a photograph, you could be prosecuted as a criminal act. And this is the lengths that our industrial agricultural community will go to protect their industry. And obviously, you know, if somebody comes out and takes a picture of my goats, they're going to get a cute picture. Same thing with Francis's beautiful Jersey cows. But when you go into a factory farm, you're likely to see hogs chewing on iron gates. You're likely to see, as Ashley mentioned, a huge manure pit, possibly with a leak in it. There are all kinds of things, which is not to say that every animal facility in Iowa has those things, but it's pretty common, and it was kind of brought on by some people who did film some atrocious mistreatment of animals and use it to whistleblow on their employers, and that's what they're trying to do is stop whistleblowing.
I have to interrupt just for a second. Off the air, could you possibly send me any links you have to this particular bill? I mean, this is important.
Well, gentlemen, let me offer you a thought. I don't think it's any secret that I practice law, and frankly, probably still do. There's an old line that old lawyers never die, they just get free advice. And the truth of the matter is that law, as it's framed, or as you've discussed it, is going to be patently unconstitutional. It's clearly in violation of First Amendment rights, although it may be upheld by a court in Iowa, considering their history and the more conservative aspects of the law, but it won't survive even at our more conservative Supreme Court level. So, you know, it's easy to make laws like this, but they're far more difficult to enforce, which I'm going to get into very shortly as we develop some other topics about a decision by the Pork Council yesterday on the EPA. So, give me back. Go ahead, Jim. Go back to where you were.
Yeah, well, you mentioned EPA and water. That's another thing that's going on in the Iowa government right now. They are trying to turn over enforcement of the Clean Water Act from the Department of Natural Resources to the Department of Agriculture. Now, Iowa's constitution states that the Department of Agriculture, one of their chief responsibilities is to promote and develop the agricultural industry in the state. Well, if that's their primary mission, and then they're being asked to enforce clean water requirements, that obviously has a strong chance of diminishing their profit return. It's not a good thing for industrial agriculture. So where are they going to go with that? Interestingly, the Secretary of Agriculture in Iowa, last summer when there was the crisis with all the salmonella-infected eggs, said, well, no, he really didn't need to look into that because that's the responsibility of the FDA. So here was an opportunity for our Secretary of Agriculture to do something about one of the dangers in our food supply, and he declined to do that, and yet now they're trying to put enforcement of the Clean Water Act into his office. So the politics of agriculture are like so many other things. I'm sure you've had many guests have discussed it with the drug industry, the medical industry, food industry, all the things that have to do with health. The money-making capitalists have gotten so much power in our legislative and administrative areas of government that it's hard for us people who are fighting for what's really right to work against them.
Well, Jim, if I can interrupt for a moment, each one of our books have at least one chapter. The first book on arthritis, gout, inflammation, Crohn's basically has a whole chapter on how the FDA and what we call Big Pharma, the pharmaceutical companies, have just twisted and contorted the use of the FDA and USDA. And in our first book, Taking Control, we chronicle the entire history of the FDA and its misconduct. But I want to stay with the water for a moment. Yesterday, I think it was, in a unanimous decision, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans ruled that the EPA cannot require livestock operations, namely CAFOs, to obtain Clean Water Act permits unless and until they have a discharge of manure into a waterway in the U.S. The court basically said the EPA exceeded its authority in requiring CAFOs that propose to or might discharge to apply for permits. And basically, it was a lawsuit brought by, of course, the National Pork Producers Council, the American Farm Bureau, the National Chicken Council, and other agricultural organizations that we all know are funded and financed by DuPont, Monsanto, ConAgra, and the rest of the group. So I want to come back to your topic about the clean water thing. First of all, even though I don't like this, the truth is the interpretation of the act is correct. And what we have is a problem in our country about legislation. There's two types, proactive and reactive legislation. And I'll be very quick with this because I want to ask you a question about it. So what happens is when we try to pass laws like the EPA, the industry opposes them. When they see they can't win, what they do then is try to dilute the laws and they try to make them reactive instead of proactive. Proactive legislation would be like the FDA, USDA, where people are hired to police and inspect and do everything else. And reactive legislation is legislation that's been diluted by the industry that says, nope, you're not going to police us. You basically can only do something about us if you catch us if we're wrong. Well, there's two aspects of it. Proactive legislation costs a lot of money. Coincidentally, at the same time, they basically reduced the spending at the USDA under this current funding act that was passed this week to keep our government going by $350 million, which was intended to slow down and cut off the USDA's policing of these events. So to save money, they try to get rid of the proactive legislation, but the real reason is to give them a shelter. And I'll end my comments with this thought. I compare this in criminal law to having a bad neighborhood in a minority community where there's no police and drug dealers and other people who are committing scores of crimes, but nobody is going to do anything until somebody catches them. So the poor neighborhood affected by all this crime keep demanding more policemen, more effort, and do something to clean up their territory, but nobody wants to spend the money to police them. And that's what's happening. He's passing the ball to the EPA, knowing that they'll only react if they catch somebody, and they're so understaffed, their chances of catching somebody is much like winning the lottery. So, Jim, you want to go on with that conversation about the water and the events?
Yeah, well, you hit really most of the things, but I can give you another direct example from Iowa that has very similar things. Again, with the EPA, and Francis, please interrupt if I get this wrong, because I'm getting some of the areas that you are really better than I am. But many of the responsibilities of the EPA are turned over to state agencies. And in Iowa, the regulation of the Clean Water Act, as I said earlier, is in the hands of the Department of Natural Resources. We have a history in Iowa where the Department of Natural Resources has not done a good job on that. And a while back, we finally got the head of the DNR really started getting on board with this and doing some things about it. And things were made rough for him, and he eventually moved on to a smaller job in South Dakota. But the other thing on this is there's a dilemma with people who are trying to enforce this. The federal government, the EPA, is stretched so thin and funded so poorly that they don't do good enforcement. But our Iowa department was doing minimal. So there was consideration to bring a lawsuit against Iowa DNR so that enforcement would be taken away from them and given back to the federal government. Now you think, well, wait a minute, if the federal's not doing a good job, why do you want to take it away from the state? Well, what we were really doing on that was trying to stimulate the DNR to do something because they do get funds from the federal government for this. If they lost the enforcement division, they'd lose all these federal funds. So, you know, it's just like you say, if you pass a law for enforcement, then the powers that be don't fund the agency so they can do their job, or else they just make it so you can't pass laws. And grassroots work is really the only way to get to that. And, you know, getting back to your original thing with JFAN, that's how JFAN came to be and what some of our goals are. There were a couple of hog confinements planned in Jefferson County, and there was basically nothing that people could do, so a handful of people got together looking at what could be done. And as the years have gone by, JFAN has become a much larger and more potent group, and we really have about three or four areas. We're a 501c3, and our primary goal is education. And that's a multifaceted thing, because some people really have limited education about agriculture, animal production, that sort of thing. And sometimes you need to inform them about good things as well as the bad things. Then, in addition to that, we monitor what's going on in our county, particularly watching to see about possible construction of new ones and violations of manure management plans, that type of thing. And then we help people to fight them, and we do that in a couple ways, through organizing people to work as a group rather than a few people who say, what can I do? And we also provide financial grants for people, sometimes to help with legal cases. In other words, JFAN as an organization, we will not pursue legal things. We don't have the grounds. But people who are living close to a CAFO have the grounds, but sometimes they don't have the financial means to. You lawyers, you know, you're pretty expensive.
Well, it's also called, the industry likes to call you guys buying plaintiffs, because that happens in the personal injury business, where it's hard to find people who can stand up to major corporations. It's intended as an insult, but they've managed to affect the laws in such a way that there's no other way for Americans to really defend themselves or to protect themselves than to jump on this bandwagon.
Right, right. So there have been a couple of instances. There has never yet been a case that has gone to trial. Just in the last 6 to 8 months, we came very close with one that was getting very close to trial. But fortunately, there was an out-of-court settlement. And if it had gone to trial, it would have been even more expensive for both sides. And there was an agreement reached between the person that had the CAFO and the 20 or 30 neighbors around. And as legal agreements, it's confidential, but everybody seems to be satisfied. The hot confinement was in operation and shut down, which is extremely unusual. It doesn't happen very often. And some of the other things we've had have been pre-construction, so we've headed off construction of some CAFOs. Now, what we hope is the effect of this in the last 5 or 6 years, and the numbers seem to bear this out, but when you're talking about negatives, it's always difficult to prove. But it appears to us that our activities, our legal things, our education, and our organization of so many people have had the effect of reducing the number of confinements that have been added to our county, Jefferson County. And when we look at a map of Jefferson County and the surrounding counties, all of the counties around us have had a much more significant increase in CAFOs in the time since we've been there. So we're proud of what we have done. We're cautious about what needs to be done. We've developed a reputation among some people that's very positive, and obviously among some other people it's extremely negative. And we found that not only is this local, but it's had some statewide impact. There's another county organized themselves much on the pattern of what we've done and called themselves the Green County Farmers and Neighbors. We've heard statewide officials, including the chief legal representative for the Cattlemen's Association, the Pork Producers, and the Farm Bureau say, Jefferson County, those people down there are crazy. And that's kind of what we want them to think. We're crazy, and just stay away from us. So in a nutshell, that's what JCAN does.
And considering there is 5,500 CAFOs or 5,000 CAFOs in Iowa, this is a serious issue. And I was reading, Jim, where there is 20,000 CAFOs or CAFOs in the United States right now. 20,000, that's huge.
Yeah.
And when
we were talking yesterday, our problem here in Iowa is primarily hog confinements, although dairy is starting to increase in northwest Iowa, and Francis can tell you about that. But your native Ohio, Michigan, California, dairy confinements are the huge problem. Now, in Iowa, you might have 5,000 or 10,000 hogs in one facility. In Michigan, you might have 8,000 dairy cows in one facility. Now, a dairy cow weighs about between 1,500 and 2,000 pounds. You can imagine how much waste that produces.
Oh, we've run statistics on it. It's incredible.
And when you were talking about the water pollution, I was really shocked to see that in Iowa, and this is probably true across the country, but I don't know, Jim, that a 7-acre lagoon may legally leak as much as 16 million gallons of liquefied manure annually.
Yeah.
And that 70% of Iowa's streams are polluted, largely due to the agricultural runoff. So this is a serious issue.
Now, this is a great time for Francis to come in, because some people say, and people who have grown up on farms and lived on farms and raise hogs in a modern method, they say poop is poop. I'm not sure if the FCC controls the language we use, but poop is poop. But Francis can tell us just exactly why there's poop and there's other poop. And that's the big difference between confinement industrial ag and sustainable agriculture, which Francis is engaged in.
Well, that's a good point. Fun. So, Francis, if you want to tell us the difference between poop, I think that mothers across the nation with young children are going, wow, this is interesting.
You see, in your summary about Francis, you get listed all those things, but you didn't indicate that he's an expert on poop.
Yeah, well, as a brief aside story, we have a lady friend who's famous for saving poodles that people leave on street corners. Because, you know, poodles are a little more demanding dog, and some people don't handle them well. The L.A. Times ran an article on her some time ago, and they referred to her as the Queen of Poop, a title that she's never been able to shake.
Of course, she was rescuing 70 to 80 dogs at a time in a small area, so this was a big deal. So,
wow.
Francis, tell us about the differences in manure, the liquid lagoons as opposed to natural organic, what's happening on your farm.
Well, you often hear people say, well, if you don't like the smell of manure, you shouldn't be in the countryside, and when they're referring to the CAFO smell. But that's not the case. What you smell when you drive by a confinement facility is not the smell of manure. You smell compounds that are created in this liquid manure pit where the manure gets in an anaerobic state and it putrefies. And in that putrefaction, over 300 volatile organic compounds are created that are of varying toxicity. Some of them we know are very toxic, like hydrogen sulfide. And if the fans go off in the confinement building for even minutes sometimes, it can kill the hogs or even the CAFO workers due to the asphyxiation from the hydrogen sulfide. So these are compounds that are created in that liquid manure pit. And now compare that to, for example, when cows are out in a pasture and they drop their manure on the soil. Just underneath that manure patty, there are literally billions of bacteria just waiting for a meal, and they're waiting to decompose that manure. And it's an aerobic process. In the presence of oxygen, the byproducts of decomposition, the gases, are all are not odorous. They're carbon dioxide and water, basically. And so there's a tremendous difference. And people don't understand that. Just today, this last week, in our local newspaper, there was an article from a Farm Bureau PR person who did a whole article about the smell of manure and how she's been around farms for so long and how that people don't understand that's how farms smell. Well, that's not right. She's totally wrong. I need to answer that guest editorial. That's not what you're smelling. You're smelling something that's created in that liquid manure pit.
Now, one of the things that happens with anaerobic, which is without oxygen, is E. coli builds up. Is this not correct? And it changes the form of the E. coli, so you have an increase of E. coli, which is one of the problems of the lagoons.
Well, yes, but that's also the case in, it's probably more of a problem in beef feedlots where they're fed a lot of corn to feed them out instead of grass. You know, a ruminant animal, a cow, has a rumen, four stomachs basically, that's made to eat grass. They evolved to eat grass. When you feed them a lot of grain, they get an acid stomach. And in that acid condition, E. coli thrives. And when we find these toxic kinds of E. coli, it's basically associated with animals eating corn. And studies have shown that if you take the animals before taking them to the slaughter plant, if you take them and put them on grass for 2 weeks, those toxic E. coli will be eliminated from their gut. But when they're eating corn, they have an acid condition and these thrive. And then, of course, when the animals are slaughtered, that manure in the stomach can get spread around onto the into the meat sometimes, or even from the animal's hide, it can get into the meat. So that's where the toxicity comes in there.
And
of course, there's another step on that too. When you're raising animals in this concentrated situation, disease, bacteria, and other disease is common. It spreads, and you know, if you have a small herd and your animals are separated, you might get three or four that are sick. If you've got 5,000 hogs in one building and something comes, it could wipe out the whole thing. So what the industrial ag people do is they feed the animals antibiotics, not as a treatment method, but as a preventive method. And in some cases, even not just even to prevent disease, but to stimulate growth. So what happens then you've got all these E. coli that Francis has been, and Ashley have mentioned, and the minimal dosage of antibiotics, which results in antibiotic-resistant bacteria. And I think, Francis, am I not correct that there have been some studies where they've studied the soil and the water downstream from confinements and the lagoons, and they've found the number of antibiotic-resistant bacteria just soars. And so
yeah,
not only do we have this manure, but we're raising bacteria that are resistant to our treatments.
Right. They found it in well water around lagoons, for example. And just to clarify, what Jim was mentioning is that they're feeding these antibiotics constantly, every day that the animals are getting the antibiotics, which biologically, thinking in terms of evolution, it's a perfect situation for bacteria to evolve resistance to that, because you're selecting the bacteria that can survive that low level of constant antibiotics, and you're selecting those that can survive in that situation. So you're really creating antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
Well, let me jump in here for a moment, Francis. We do a little bit every week on recalls, primarily beef recalls. So I ran up a few for us today. On January 10th of this year, the USDA increased a recall of more than 225,000 pounds of ground beef to include another undisclosed and undetermined amount from One Great Burger of Elizabeth, New Jersey. On February 6th, for example, the USDA recalled more than 3,000 pounds of ground beef from an American Food Service of Pico Rivera, a suburb of Los Angeles. On March 8th, for example, the USDA recalled 14,158 pounds of ground beef products that were contaminated with E. coli from Creekstone Farms Premium Beef in Arkansas City, Kansas, excuse me. On March 1st, they recall more than 64,000 pounds of chicken and pork from Taylor Farms Pacific in Tracy, California, which is by San Francisco. And on March 22nd, the USDA recalled approximately 23 pounds of Lebanon bologna products contaminated with E. coli. And we've been saying for a lot of times, and by the way, we list all these water problems in our book. We give the statistics in Maryland, for example, the Potomac was completely contaminated. And as both of you know, in North Carolina in 1995, the New River was totally contaminated. So what you're saying is backed up by what the products that hit the store, and it's our position in our books that this is caused by factory farming and feeding genetically modified corn. Now, Francis has reminded us that any corn eaten by cattle or cows is a problem. But the genetically modified one, which is split with the BT bacteria, is basically, or actually BT is a virus, a toxin, right, leaves residues which contribute to this problem and contribute to problems with E. coli and the rest of them. So at every phase and every stage of factory farming and factory slaughtering, because many of the factory farms own their own slaughterhouse, we have this problem. And basically, I believe that's what you're saying, is that every step along this way leads to my comment that whatever happens on these Iowa farms with the factory farming ends up on the tables of America. So, Jim, do you agree with that?
I would agree with that completely, and it leads to another thing that we had planned to talk about today, and that's the comparison of factory farming and local food, sustainable, which is usually local food. Most of those recalls that you indicated, you were talking about hundreds of thousands of pounds of ground beef.
Yes.
But when you're doing local food and there's a problem, you can trace it. If you buy a half a beef from your neighbor down the road, or you get it from the locker plant, and you say, well, I bought my meat on May 25th, well, that local processing plant might have done, you know, 5 or 10 cattle on that day, and they know right away where it is, and you're talking about a very small amount of food. When you're talking about the factory farm issues and the huge packing plants, in order to identify, they've got to recall hundreds of thousands of pounds of meat or spinach or milk or eggs, whatever it is. The egg recalls that we had in Iowa last year, they were recalling millions of eggs. So local food, sustainable food, is the way for us to go if we want to have a healthy lifestyle.
Okay,
and of course,
can I ask a really simple question? The industry, the big food, big ag industry, basically says this is the way we have to do it to maintain food production required to feed the population. Is it possible to feed the 354 million people that live in the U.S. By using sustainable products?
Well, absolutely it is. And another point I wanted to add on about that with the large-scale industrial food processing, if you saw the movie Food, Inc., you see that, for example, in hamburger production, scraps from the floors, from feedlots, slaughterhouses all over the country can get congregated and together in one processing plant. And so then if you have an isolated contamination incident somewhere in the country and that gets put into this huge lot and then it gets in process, hamburger gets shipped across the country, suddenly you've taken one isolated contamination incident, multiplied it, and made it a national food recall problem. Whereas like Jim said, if food is locally produced, if there's an isolated contamination incident, it remains isolated. That's a huge difference. But yes, we absolutely can. I mean, think of it this way. People often ask me, well, how can you possibly raise as much food when animals are grazing instead of in the confinement? Because in the confinement, you have so many animals in one place. Yeah, but you have to remember that you're bringing their feed from all over a larger area. You're bringing that feed in concentrated and then concentrating and giving the animals, then have to haul the manure back out to the field. Whereas if you had the animals harvest their own feed in the pasture, it's the same amount of feed either way. One way, in the industrial system, you're hauling it to the animals. In the grazing system, the animals are going and eating their own feed, the same amount. And as a matter of fact, we're raising this grass in a way that's actually enhancing the soil, building the soil, making it more productive over time, whereas the industrial system of row crop farming is losing soil faster than it's regenerating, and it's in a downward spiral, the fertility is. And so,
Francis, go into that a little bit more, because I've heard you talk about this before, and it, to me, it's a fascinating and amazing thing about how wonderful a food machine the cow is, and you know, the fact about expending total amount of energy with the cow. You're not using gas, and with industrial ag, you are.
Yeah, if you look at it, let's take a dairy, for example, a confinement dairy. The cows are confined by the milking facility. So you have to harvest the grass, haul it to the animals, store it, feed the animals day by day, and then collect the manure in storage and haul it back out to the field. Whereas if you have a well-designed grazing system, in our case we have 60 small pastures, and the cows get fresh grass after each milking. All we do twice a day after each milking is open the next pasture. The cows go in the pasture, we close the gate, the cows harvest their own feed, they spread their own manure right where it needs to be in a way that's ecologically sound, and they enjoy their work, and they are in a healthy environment, in a healthy lifestyle, eating a healthy diet. And so all that energy that you're using to bring the feed and the manure back and forth to the cave hole, you've eliminated from the system when you have the animals harvest their own feed in that way.
And what was interesting to me, Francis, is how you and Susan bought this land in 1996, and the soil was destroyed, according to your book. And, tell the story how since 1996 you've taken this land, you have a complete dairy farm, you're totally sustainable, you know, within your own farm. I mean, this is amazing what you've done.
Well, when we bought the farm, it had been in corn and soybean production for many years, and it's very steep land. It really isn't suitable for row cropping like that because it leaves it vulnerable to erosion. Well, it had been eroded so badly that some places all the topsoil was gone from the hillsides, and it was down to the subsoil. And there were some gullies all where the waterways were supposed to be grass waterways. Some places the gullies were 4 feet deep. And it had been farmed by an absentee. It was an absentee landlord who was renting it to somebody else who didn't own it. So they didn't take very good care of it either. But so we fixed all the gullies. We planted the whole farm into grasses and clovers, a diversity. And so because we have perennial cover on the land now, it protects it from erosion. And it also protects it, the nutrients from leaving the soil and getting into the rivers. And so it's a much more sustainable system. So instead of in the past where we were losing soil constantly, now we're in the process where we're actually building soil. The longer we farm, we're building soil. And I think that we can design farming systems in a way that actually enhance the natural resource base that will improve soil quality, improve water quality, improve air quality, sequester carbon from the air into the soil, and improve wildlife habitat.
Now, you also went to Cuba and saw what they had going on in Cuba at one point. Can you tell us about that, your experience, and did it help?
Well, it was very interesting. I was on a tour group in the 1990s that went to Cuba, a scientific study crew, a group, and it was legal that way as a group of scientists. And what we saw there was, of course, after the Soviet Union collapsed around 1990, suddenly Cuba, which had been very industrialized in its agriculture, it lost all the inputs. Basically, the pesticides and the fertilizers and most of the fuel was lost because it was being provided to them by the Soviet Union. And Cuba had very much Soviet Union-style farming, big CAFOs and the big collective. And so suddenly, overnight, they didn't have that, and they had to reinvent their agriculture without any chemicals. And they went to organic farming overnight. Fortunately, they had some research institutes in place before that had put together some models for how they could farm in ways that were organic and ecologically sound. And so they were able to take those models and get them out to the farms, and they made a successful transition. They were pretty hungry for a while, but they emphasized that nobody actually really went hungry. People, you know, it was a little bit of a tight on food, but their society was set up so nobody really went hungry and starved. One interesting comment on that is that they were, for example, looking at grazing. Previously, they had their animals in confinement, and they said that the previous era they now called farming on wheels, where they hauled everything to the animals or hauled everything back to the fields. Now the animals were harvesting it, and they were developing models that they were measuring how much energy it took. And they were finding that for each calorie of fossil fuel energy, they were getting 10 to 15 calories of food back. And in the previous era, it took 10 calories of fossil fuels to make 1 calorie of food.
Wow.
So they had become much more energy self-sufficient in the new system.
I just wanted you to tie this up, but in a sort of a simple statement to everybody about really the circle of life, to steal a line out of an old Disney movie. But there's a circle of life that goes with farming, particularly cattle, cows, and how it mixes with the soils and the grass and the rest of them. And the factory farming, which you're demonstrating in Cuba, break that circle. And I think you're telling us that Cuba rediscovered the circle, that you're basically doing the same thing on your farm, and that what we need to do is rediscover that circle across the board.
And if I could just summarize it to say that basically that the way we've been farming industrially is only possible with cheap fossil fuels, and we are at the end of the cheap fossil fuel era, and we're going to have to change. And so the sooner we can get ourselves on this mode of change, the better off we're going to be. But this will not be possible to farm that way in the future because we're not going to have that abundant cheap fossil fuels.
And that draws us back to the question that you posed a few minutes back about can we produce the food that we need in sustainable or localized agriculture? And the answer is yes, we can. Contrast what Francis talked about with Cuba, getting away from that type of ag, getting to a localized, more natural form, with what's happened in Central America in the last 20 years, primarily because of NAFTA. For thousands of years, they have been raising corn and feeding the local population, and then also the diversified types of things. NAFTA came in, and we flooded Central America and Mexico with cheap American corn. In fact, it was so cheap that the local farmers, even living on a sort of a basic subsistence level, couldn't compete. So Mexico began buying American carbon supplemented corn, and it put all those farmers out of business. And so they're using our, quote, cheap, because when we talk about cheap food in this country, we don't take into consideration, as Francis talked about, all the petroleum that goes into producing it, all the problems with the health and the diet that you guys talk about in your books. All these things are really factored into the cost. So when we talk cheap food, we're talking about the dollars that you spend at the supermarket, not the cost to society and our health.
And
that's an
also,
excellent point.
And I think the other point, too, is something that you and I discussed, is our concern for the socioeconomic problems and the fact that unemployment, cheap labor, and other things factor in. And Ashley had a point. She wanted to join in on this, too.
Well, on March 3rd, 2011, the UN report on eco-farming states that many farmers in developing nations can double the food production within a decade by shifting to ecological agriculture away from use of chemical fertilizers and pesticides. And they found that the eco-farming projects in 57 nations had shown an average crop yield gains of 80% by tapping natural methods for enhancing soil and protecting against pests. And 20 African countries had resulted in doubling of the crop yields within 3 to 10 years, which I thought was a really important document, which was recent, March 3rd.
Look, let me guess, that this wasn't a Monsanto-sponsored study.
Absolutely not.
We knew that would come up sometime today.
So Monsanto I refer to as the Darth Vader of corporations. Corporate Watch once dubbed him the foremost corporate criminal in the world. And you've got to work hard for that kind of designation in life.
It's stunning to me that there is no human studies done on this GMO that is in abundance and in 87 to 90% of all packaged and processed foods, especially when the studies early on scientific data and the current scientific data shows in animals how with the horrible effect it has on the animals. Animals die.
Yeah, so I want to come back to something near and dear to Jim, because Ashley brings it up all the time, is my concern that, as Jim points out, it's the dairy farms are getting larger and larger, and that what we're getting is a form of milk that's basically been fed with genetically modified corn, has the daily doses of antibiotics that Jim discussed, and worse yet, is given RGBH, human growth hormones. In our previous conversation, Francis had mentioned that he saw it declining and was really receding in your area, but yet Ashley and I find instances where it doesn't seem to be changed in states like Iowa and other ones who have much different viewpoints on this. So it may be that we still have that problem where these cows are being fed growth hormones that go with specifically the antibiotics. And I think that raises a serious concern about our milk. And, Jim, I know this is Francis, something near and dear to you. So would you give us your feelings about that? Francis, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Well, I'm not certain how much the RGBH is being used right now. It's a little unclear. Most of the major dairies in Iowa do not allow farmers to use it, but I can't really say how widely it's used. Now, antibiotics in dairy are a little different thing. Antibiotics in dairy farm are closely monitored, and dairy cows are not routinely fed antibiotics. Every batch of milk is tested for antibiotics, and if it exceeds the threshold of the test, it's rejected. And so
are you talking organic versus capo?
I'm talking all milk. All milk is
okay.
Has to be. Even our little dairy processing plant, we're organic. We never use antibiotics, but we have to still test by law. Have to test our milk for antibiotics, which is a little ironic. But all milk is tested widely. Now you have to admit that there's a threshold to these tests, and I've heard of cases from dairy fieldmen that sometimes a batch of milk was tested positive, but they didn't get the test until it was too late. And that milk was combined with a huge silo full of other milk, and it was no longer tested. You could never no longer be found in the big silo full of milk because it was diluted so much. And there are some people who are very sensitive to those low levels of antibiotics. I know some people in particular personally. But dairy is not, dairy cows are not routinely fed antibiotics or else the milk would be rejected.
Interesting.
I was reading about a Michigan farmer who had stated that they, I'm going to do his direct quote, he farms the dairy cows, and he said, like beef, are sprayed with pesticides, doused with antibiotics, hormones, and tranquilizers, which shocked me as the tranquilizers. The chemical residue is passed on to all those who consume their milk, taking over and affecting the health of everyone, including young children. So in Michigan, it may be a different state ruling, or is this a national ruling or a state ruling with the antibiotics in dairy milk?
It's national. It's gotten very, very strict in recent times, the antibiotic thing. Now, there are hormones that are used for breeding and, of course, you know, the BST. So the hormones are not tested for. And pesticides aren't tested for either in the milk. And so
same with antibiotics, right? They don't test those or tranquilizers, correct?
Well, yeah, antibiotics are tested for.
Oh, yeah.
But not,
okay.
Not anything else is probably routinely tested for. And if animals are given pesticides for flies or something, that isn't tested for that I know about. And it's not a mandatory test that I know of anywhere.
Did you say antidepressants? Is that why when I have a cup of hot chocolate in the evening, it just kind of mellows me out and puts me to sleep?
That's it. It has nothing to do with that L-tryptophan.
I want Francis to tell another story about his farm, because this was amazing to me. You mentioned pesticides, and Francis, of course, has an organic farm, so he does not use pesticides. And when I was visiting Francis' farm in the summer several times, I said, Francis, there's no flies here. Now, I grew up on a dairy farm in Minnesota, and in the summertime, we had flies all over the place. I said, Francis, how do you have 80 cows and no flies? So tell us what you do, Francis.
Well, I won't say there are no flies. We do the best we can. It's like we're talking about pesticides for fly control, which is a common approach, and it's like Bill McKibben says, we shouldn't look for a silver bullet to solve our problems. We should look for a silver buckshot. A lot of things that all together work to solve the problem. And so we have a lot of things that we do on the farm. One is that we have chickens, free-range chickens running around the farmyard, and they will eat the fly larvae before they hatch. So that helps a lot. And then we also...
Wait, I'm gonna ask you to go one step further on this, Francis, because it's really interesting to me when you talk about your paddocks. Not only does he have chickens, but he times his cattle in the paddocks and then times the chickens. So he puts the chickens in the paddock, 3 days after the cows have been there, so that they're there right when the larvae are hatching?
Well, we used to do that. Now we've had trouble with coyotes eating the chickens so badly that we've not continued. A lot of farmers have done this kind of thing, though. But since we've diversified our farm, we have a whole lot more wildlife and birds. We have, for example, wild turkeys that run around where the cows have been, and they probably do some of the jobs the chickens were supposed to do. And we have swallows flying over the cows constantly, probably eating flies, and we've had cowbird flocks. We've seen cowbirds sitting on cows' backs and on their faces, and even cow egrets. So we have, you know, the wildlife doing some of what the chickens had done in the past out there in the pastures. But
that's even better. Yeah, do you guys think there's much wildlife in a CAFO?
The only wildlife you're going to see at CAFOs is flies. And have you talked about CAFOs before so that your listeners know about the composting that goes on at CAFOs?
Oh, no. We want to hear again, though. Please tell us. I want to hear your point of view on that.
We probably have new listeners, we hope.
Composting usually sounds... you know, really good. It's what you put on your garden, and it's this natural thing. Well, this is not composting manure. CAFOs have the pits for their manure.
How large are these pits, Jim?
Well, typically they're the same size as the building. It used to be that they had a lot of outdoor pits, and there were problems with them, so now they're typically underneath the building. So they hold, what, Francis, 1 million gallons? I'm bad at numbers. But,
yeah,
you
know,
they're huge. They're 6-8 feet deep and bigger than 3 or 4 football fields. But the composting, what they compost at hog CAFOs, is dead pigs. So in the winter, if there's a flu goes through or pneumonia or something else, and they have a bunch of dead pigs, they put them in this big concrete pit, and they cover them up with sawdust, and they compost those pigs. Now, isn't that sweet?
So they take these sick, dead pigs and put them in, and that's what's actually going to go fertilizing the fields of the spinach?
I think that's what they do with them eventually, is that it's spread onto the fields, yeah. But, you know, basically, there used to be the rendering trucks came to the farms and processed dead animals. Well, two things. One, that's not so economically feasible anymore. Number two, these CAFOs, when you've got 10,000 hogs on one place, you've got too many dead animals, because I think they usually expect about 3% mortality with pigs or something like that. That's a lot of dead pigs. So they compost them.
That is a lot of dead pigs. Oh. And I have a friend
who has a small CAFO, and he's got a composting pile, and he says, yeah, you ought to see the size of some of those rats in that compost pile.
I bet they are.
I'm sorry, those of you are somewhere at Mountain Time, it's noon, they're eating lunch. I hope you're not eating bacon.
So I understand it takes 6 months to a year of fermentation of these lagoons. That the manure stays there to ferment for that time period?
Well, they're usually emptied out every 6 months or sometimes once a year only. And so that's just because that's when they get around to taking it out. So it can sit there for quite a while, yes.
So the animals are actually marinating in the... Sorry.
Where do they empty the stuff to?
Well, the manure is taken out and injected in, either injected into the soil in the fields or else spread on the surface. And you hope that you don't live by somebody who spreads it on the soil surface.
Or particularly not an area where there's still snow on the ground is frozen, and you just spray it over the top.
Yes, we found some articles, and I thought it was
JFAN. It was JFAN.
It was JFAN. Isn't that occurred in your area?
Yeah. Well, two things on that. Number one, the guy I mentioned before with the rat, he's a fairly responsible factory farmer. There's another character in our county who is much larger and is much less reputable. About 3 years ago, his neighbors were out early spring. Guy was out with a game warden, and they were looking at some things, and they saw that he was applying his manure. There was still snow on the ground. But the ground had thawed. He got down to the lower part of the field, about 20 or 30 yards from a small stream, spring, the water was running. He got stuck. And so what he did when he was stuck, he pulled the plug on his applicator and just drained out several thousand gallons of raw sewage that ran down the field and into the stream.
Oh, my God.
Great.
So this is the type of thing that goes on with irresponsible operators. This is not the case with everybody. There are a lot of really responsible people. And Francis Menton mentioned open spreading and injecting. More and more of the farmers are doing the injection now, which very much reduces the odor. I think there's still runoff problems because most of the fields that they inject the manure into are tiled. And, of course, with tile, when you have a concentration of any kind of liquid, instead of staying in the soil, it goes into the tile lines and drains off the field faster. So, you know, it's just this whole series and cycle of things that contribute to the problems that we have.
Well, considering that 1.4 billion tons of waste per year from the CAFOs, or CAFOs, that is, and you put it in perspective of what you're saying, it's horrible.
Here's another little interesting sidelight. There's a little town called Martinsburg, about 30 miles from Fairfield, and JFAN was involved in stopping one particular CAFO in that area a few years back, but there were several others that had been there before and others that came in. Martinsburg is a town of about 140 or 150 people, very small. About 5 years ago, EPA said that they needed to put in a municipal sewage system because most of the people had their own private septic systems. And a few of them probably were defective. Some of them were probably just fine. So this town of 140 people spent something like $3 or $4 million putting in a municipal sewage system. About the time they finished their sewage system, these CAFOs went in, and surrounding this town within about 2 miles are, I think, about 15,000 hogs. All the waste from those 15,000 hogs goes directly onto the ground, untreated. But 140 people had to spend $3 million.
Very
wow. You know, that to me, that is criminal.
Well, no, it's just, it underscores the ability of big business to control what goes on through financing and political contributions. That's the bottom line. And that's probably the biggest problem that you have with KFAN, with JFAN, is that you're not fighting ordinary individuals. You're fighting probably the largest single and most persuasive lobby in our country.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Francis, I'm going to quote something from your book, and maybe we could talk a little bit about this so people understand the seriousness of the CAFO within a community. A study published in the American Journal of Agriculture Economics in 2009 found that a doubling of CAFO numbers in a county was linked to a 7.3% increase in infant mortality. In that study, an increase of 100,000 animal units in a county corresponded to 123 more infant deaths per year per 100,000 births. Now, we recently had a recall because 35 people died from a pedal on a car. I read this and I go, 123 more infant deaths per 100,000 births, and I don't understand how this can continue.
Well, actually, the reason it continues is it's sort of like the smoking thing. Look how long it took to get the smoking bans in place. And the industry will say, yes, that's a correlation, but that doesn't prove that it's a cause and effect. Just like cancer, people who smoked had high rates of cancer, but it didn't prove in the eyes of the industry that it really was the cause. And so that's how they're stringing this out and saying there's really no proven cause and effect.
Oh, yes, that's definitely the corporate method of handling adverse things. You hear it mostly, in my opinion, with GMOs. I mean, basically, I hear people say all the time, well, prove to me that GMOs are bad. And I say to them, well, I think the burden's on the industry to have proven that GMOs are good before they were given the opportunity to put GMOs in the marketplace. But I'm sure you two are aware that Michael Taylor, a lobbyist in Washington, D.C. for Monsanto, was placed in the position of ushering this in the 90s, and he basically took whatever criticism that existed and had it buried. So if you're going to put the foxes in the hen house to make these decisions, then you're not going to get any kind of credible information, and the burden is going to be placed on the public because basically, the FDA, and it admits such, is biotech-friendly. They are pushing biotech not only here, but around the world.
And concentrating the wealth. We mentioned that I grew up on a farm, so 50 years ago, my dad had this little piece of wooden equipment called a fanning mill. And neighboring farmers would come with their grain, usually soybeans, but sometimes oats or wheats. And, you know, they had harvested their own product, and before they seeded it, they wanted to run it through this fanning mill to get rid of all the weed seeds and the infertile chaff and the cracked seeds and all that sort of thing. So he had this little thing that you put seed in by the bucket full, and the farmers would pay him, you know, maybe $5 or a dollar or something to run their things through it, and they'd go plant their seed. Well, today with Monsanto, if a farmer plants GMO corn that he harvested from his field that he planted, he's liable. It's prohibited. He can't do that. And in one of the food films, again, there's a story about some guy who was going around secretly fanning the seed for these farmers so that they could do a little bit, and finally they put them out of business. So
yeah,
it's the
Illinois,
concentration.
Yeah.
It's the concentration of wealth.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about that. I describe in the books a period of what I call corporate robber barons. It is akin to the robber barons in the late 19th century. And the difference is we had the Fords and the Rockefellers and Edison and everybody who had really advanced this world with these basic inventions and then tried to take over the world because of their inventions. And but what we have now is no longer individuals. We have heartless corporations that are doing this that have no other real base. And they have a mentality that I think is born out of malignant narcissism that goes on in our schools. And then they're fostered by universities. In our book, we chronicle how more than, I think it's what, 1,700 professors at Harvard were caught taking basically bribes from the drug industry to promote drug products, particularly Stanton drugs. And Harvard did a little about it because they admitted they were concerned about losing their funding. So over a period of time, this has become a major problem in our country. And I might point out that Ashley found an extremely good book that was written in the late 1940s. The name isn't come right up for me right now. But it basically chronicled how the Rockefeller Foundation started doing this, back in the early 1920s, and how industry has taken the education of young doctors and others and turned this into a profit center.
Well, Francis, I'm sure, will have something to say about Iowa State, unless he doesn't want to get into trouble with them. Iowa State is a land-grant institution that one of their specialties is agriculture and veterinary medicine. And as the years have passed, state funding of our universities continues to go down. And so in order to fund the schools, the universities do research. And to fund the research, they turn to outside funding. Well, Iowa State Agriculture, who did they get their funding from? John Deere, Monsanto, Caterpillar, Pioneer, Cargill. They get it from industrial agriculture. So are they doing research on sustainability, natural methods, local foods? No. They're doing research that's going to benefit the corporations.
Well, interesting. Let me point out something interesting. One of our guests, Dr. Dan Tini, who's an expert in fibromyalgia and all this, points out every time we talk to him that 25 years ago, the National Institutes of Health basically funded 80 to 90% of all research. Now it's the other way around. 90% of the research is funded by private corporations, and only 10% is funded by the National Institutes of Health. And with that went all semblance of any type of objective testing.
This also makes sense to me because when I was reading through the University of Iowa with the JFAN, I've been looking at a lot more studies from the University of Iowa and also from reading your book, Francis. And consistently, one of the things I've seen with Monsanto's testing, because they test their own stuff, which is so unscientific. It's, you know, I don't know. You know, the I don't know that continues on with these scientists is just, it's bunk. And when I'm looking at the University of Iowa, I now understand where I'm looking at something right now for MRSA and how MRSA is definitely connected into the CAFOs and how not only the hogs are affected, but the swine are affected. And at the end of it, it'll say, but this is a maybe. Wait a minute, you just ran the test. You absolutely know the percentage on it. This is an absolute, and now you're now saying it's a maybe? So that they can then get more funding to then continue more testing. And I understand now that I understand where the funds are coming from because it is follow the money. We discovered that with the RDAs. RDAs are funded by M&M, Nestle's, your top food companies are funding the RDAs, your recommended daily allowances. Same thing here.
Okay, I would point out that it's Iowa State University. University of Iowa is the one that is more of the liberal arts college. Iowa State is a land-grant university. And if I could just add one little point on that is that if we recognize that the land-grant universities are, the infrastructure is mostly supported by state and federal budgets. And so the infrastructure, meaning the buildings and the base salaries of the researchers, And then what happens is that the industry comes by and offers a grant that has to be matched by the university to do research. And so this is their only, the researchers, this is their major source of outside funding. So the industry will take a small amount of money and leverage the whole infrastructure of the university to do research for them. So they get a real bonus. They only have to pay a small amount, and they get all that public money being leveraged to do their research.
Oh, absolutely.
Jim, I have to ask you a question, and it has to be pointed at you rather than Francis. I know that your farm is more about crops than animals. How concerned are you about cross-contamination from GMO crops from other farms?
My farm is not organic, and so it's not a concern for me. But if I was an organic farmer, I would be extremely concerned. And once again, we're looking at the unlevel playing field. They are manipulating things so that if an organic farmer is growing natural crops and he's next to a field that has GMO crops, the natural farmer is the one that gets in trouble for the cross-pollination. And can you explain that a little more, Francis?
If not, I'll be happy to. Ash and I've written a lot on how the food, what are called the food police are talking about. Monsanto's the private investigators.
Well, I want to hear Francis' point of view on it.
Well, I'd rather hear Manny Phillips.
No, I'm like, I want to hear your point of view on this.
I'll jump in when you're done.
Francis has got Jersey cows. And if Francis builds a good fence, but his neighbor has got Herefords, and the Hereford bull breaks down the fence and comes and breeds Francis's cow, and then instead of having a good dairy-producing Jersey, he gets this Hereford Jersey mix. It's like he's responsible, and the guy with the bull gets to collect. How can that work?
Well, let's go to the basis of it. As you know, there's a Supreme Court ruling that basically granted Monsanto what are called property rights and their patents. So in essence, they became the owners of what they create, which is one of the reasons that we're so upset besides what goes into transgenic animals. The fact that one company could possibly own animals is really quite frightening. So once that decision was made, which incidentally was authored by Justice Clarence Thomas, who, gee whiz, was a former Monsanto lawyer. Wonder why he was so motivated, right? So another example of foxes in the hen house. So with this law in hand, they're able to assert some legal theories that are disturbing to every lawyer I know. And as you talk about how it affects us now, just imagine if Monsanto, considering their personality and their reputation, reached a point where they had this level of control over a larger sector of what we grow in this country. It could be catastrophic. It would essentially wipe out all freedom that farmers have and make them indentured servitudes, which we believe is the whole purpose of what they're doing right now. So I hope that gives you a feeling for it.
And it's related to what corporations are doing all over the world. Francis talks a lot about monoculture and how bad it is as compared to a diversified farming base and what is happening throughout the third world because of Norman Borlaug and his Green Revolution, and it was a revolution against the common people. When you look at India and South America, various places where villages raised everything that they needed to live in a small area, now they come and they say, oh, well, we've got this new miracle rice you can grow and grow all this rice. So they start growing the rice, but they lose their independence. They're no longer self-sufficient. They have to buy their food. And so, you know, we're already in that monoculture situation, but we're spreading it throughout the world.
That's true. Well, of course, India, as you know, is starting to finally resist them, which hopefully they're going to be more successful. Strangely enough, we've had a large demand from both India and Pakistan to reprint a great number of our articles that are critical of Monsanto. And recently, Monsanto was found making a deal behind the back of the Indian government with a variety of scientists that it basically allowed them to grow genetically modified wheat without the knowledge of the government. I mean, they've just been absolutely incredible. And
they've been caught in bribes and, you know, bribes in Indonesia. I mean, they bribe. If you can't change the law, just bribe them seems to be their attitude.
Well, let's talk about some of the things going on in India while you brought it up. In a small village in India where buffalo grazed on GMO regular cotton plants for at least 8 years without incident, in 1908, the buffalo started grazing on BT. 2008. The buffaloes started grazing on BT cotton plants for the first time. All 13 were sick the next day. All died within 3 days. BT corn was also implicated in the death of cows in Germany and horses and water buffaloes and a wide variety of other things. But
it's the same BT cotton seeds that they're using that's going into the olive oil. So people aren't buying organic. They're getting the same thing that was killing animals.
Well, let's talk about the more serious one that involves Monsanto. According to the National Crime Records Bureau of India, more than 182,900 farmers committed suicide between 1997 and 2007. The Crimes Bureau estimated 46 farmers commit suicide every day, which is about roughly one super suicide every half hour. The desperation in Indian farmers has been traced to a number of different studies in India back to Monsanto in their ruthless drive to control the testing and use of their GMO products. And so this is showing up in many different ways. And why is India important? Because they've been testing in the northern section of India that's untouched by other elements of agriculture. It's almost a virgin territory for testing. So there are really no other things that these problems can be blamed on other than Monsanto and the GMOs, where here in this country they're able to say, oh, well, there are other factors or this or that. But in a controlled population, in a controlled growing area, an animal area, these tests have been extraordinarily detrimental to their reputation, detrimental to their products. So that's part of the problem, Francis, that I see. And by the way, do you think Monsanto's concerned with the number of people who die in India? The same way in our book we published studies of a variety of drug companies who were testing infant formulas in Nigeria and killed, you know, thousands of children and maimed hundreds more, and they tried to criminally prosecute the officers of this particular corporation, and they bribed their way out with a $65 million payment to the government, which, of course, never went to the children or the families. And that's also true of the Bhopal disaster in India when Union Carbide plant exploded. None of that money. They built one hospital, and all the rest of the money went to the government, and everybody was left, the millions of people who were harmed. And that's an example of what we're talking about with these corporate robber barons that are raping and pillaging the world, and that's what they're doing. So if you have any feelings on that, Jim, please jump in.
You know, you mentioned payments, and we've been talking primarily about agriculture today. Nigeria, Shell Oil pays huge amounts of money to Nigeria because of problems they have, but huge numbers of farmers can't farm because of the burn-off of natural gas, which scorches the country. The rivers have become no fish because of all the continual spills. But it's bad enough with petroleum, but what we're talking about today is food. You know, the basic thing that we need to live is food and shelter. And
those are primal needs.
Yeah, it's a primal need, and profit money making has moved in, and you know, they talk about the global economy, and what I've said is that the global economy just means that corporations are able to steal from the whole world instead of just their own country.
Absolutely.
And they're getting rid of the middle class. I mean, you know, if they can push everybody out so that they rule, it's really horrible.
Well, and what bothers me the most is, because I've also, Francis, taught at the various college levels and lectured for years, is this is done through the manipulation of the colleges. And one of the things that has severely tainted my profession as a lawyer is that most major law schools basically teach young lawyers how to do what we call discovery, which you know is sending interrogatories and taking depositions, so they're competent to go to work for big law firms immediately out of law school. So they basically prepare lawyers to do nothing but churn files and basically generate income for big law firms instead of my day when you were forced to work at Neighborhood Legal and other places that required you to gain some understanding of the needs of the community. I don't think there are any lawyers except some serious projects that involve finding people who've been wrongfully accused of crimes and some of the DNA groups that you've seen to specialize in helping prisoners out. But by and large, there's very little effort to make law students participate in something that would enhance their understanding of society. I think the same is true in almost every area of teaching. Tyson runs, as you know, Tyson Foods runs the section at the University of Arkansas that trains young men to go into commerce and primarily trains them in the ways of Tyson's, which we all know is not exactly our favorite factory farmer. So I think that's a major problem at every university.
You know, it's something that you just mentioned there, too, goes back to what we were talking about, local food. And one of the things they talk about why local food is good is it gives a consumer connection to the product that he's eating. You know what you're eating. You know where it comes from. There's a connection. But something I think that people don't talk about enough is that local food also gives a connection from the producer to his customer. When a guy is working in a factory farm with 5,000 hogs, he's not thinking about his neighbor eating that hog. He's thinking about the monthly check that he gets from Cargill or Triumph Foods or Christensen or whoever it is. And once you lose that connection to the customer, you don't really care, because if you gave more antibiotics to your pigs a week before they're going to market than you should, well, it's not the neighbor. It's, well, I'm going to get my good money from Cargill. They got plenty of money. It doesn't make any difference. So that whole connection, it works the whole way around. And when you lose that, we lose quality.
Well, I agree. Anytime you lose touch with your customer and it becomes impersonal, there's an immediate lack of caring about that customer. That's extremely dangerous to really the survival of our country, because people talk about the changes in importing things and how we're becoming a service country. Well, we're not, because we don't service people in this country. Basically, you're going to get what is typical of most corporations, a little computer answering machine that says to you, push this button or push that button. And in many respects, that's become a symbol of these major corporations. So, I want to come back to Iowa.
Sorry, we're getting cut in?
Are we losing everybody?
No, I'm still here.
Okay.
I'm here.
I want to come back to your daily dealing with this. One of the things that I find interesting is that basically Francis supplies all the local stores with their dairy. So there's
within a 5 mile radius.
Well, that's where the local stores. 5 miles is a lot of area where they are. But yet everyone else, products go, as you say, all around the country. So not only are we having problems with the recall issues, but we're also having problems in determining freshness of products. We grow our own vegetables, for example, and quite well, I might add. At the end of the day, our food is so fresh it lasts forever in the refrigerator, but most of the food in the market spoils very quickly. And I wonder if you have any thoughts about that.
Well, that's true. In dairy, for example, our dairy process three times a week, and so –
on processing day, the milk goes right to the store, so it turns over very quickly. Is there an echo when I'm talking?
Yes, I hear an echo.
Yeah,
this might be, if you're on a cell phone, it sounds like a cell phone issue.
Yeah, and we're down to the last few seconds here, but I do want to go quickly around the table. Jim, do you have some parting thoughts for us?
Well, there's one topic we wanted to cover, but I don't have time in a few seconds, and that has to do with the change in rural landscape as industrial ag takes over. But no time
and
for
Jim,
that.
It's been a real joy talking
to you people.
Jim Francis, why don't you plan on coming back and joining us in a couple of weeks? We have an open date about then, and let's come back and jump into some of these areas that we weren't able to finish. I apologize, Simon. I actually lost track of time today, which is not like me.
And I'm still waiting to find out how to make cheese and yogurt, because that's a big deal, and I get asked that question a lot. So, Francis, please, I want to hear about how you make this on the farm.
Go ahead, Simon. You can check us out, and I apologize to a group of people who I wanted to give promos today for various events, but we certainly will next week. Go ahead, Simon.
We will indeed. Jim and Francis, I really, really want to thank you for taking time to talk with us today. It was informative. It was hugely informative. And I do hope that you'll be able to join us in a couple of weeks to go for round two.
Sounds great to me.
Thank you, gentlemen, and hope you have a nice weekend. Goodbye.
Thank you. Thank you to the listeners.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.